So today I'm here with Bill Ickes, who is a university researcher in Texas and has written a book which actually isn't that well known, but I think is, as someone that's been researching autism and understanding empathy, I think he's written the most phenomenal book that I've seen. And the name of the book is Everyday Mind Reading, Understanding What Other People Think and Feel. I actually don't tend to interview book authors here, but this book was just so incredibly phenomenal and can lead to such a profound understanding of empathy that I just had to get Bill here. So, Bill, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Adrian.
Can you maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and where you come from?
I can. I didn't set out with the goal of becoming a research psychologist. My original goal was to work in advertising and make a pile of money. My first psych course suggested that maybe I needed to make a course correction, but I stayed an English major, which I was starting out, and added psychology as a minor, and then eventually realized that I did have strong research interests, and that a lot of the ideas and themes from the study of English literature could be incorporated into psychology. In particular, I thought that it might be possible to treat the interactions of people in a laboratory setting as little mini dramas. Basically, the concept is to put two people together and then eavesdrop on their conversations and let their personalities write the script for them. So, for example, if you put two strangers together, one who was highly agreeable and one who was highly disagreeable, how would that interaction unfold? Would the disagreeable person ruin it for the agreeable one? Would the agreeable one be able to apply social skills to smooth out the rough edges of the disagreeable person? So we spent about 10 years after I got my PhD studying effects of people's personality traits on their initial interactions in the laboratory. And toward the end of that time, I began to realize we could extract a lot more information from these initial interactions than we had been. We'd been looking at how much people look at each other, smile at each other, how close they sit on the couch, and so on. But there was a whole other dimension of the interactions we weren't tapping, and that was what was going on in the privacy of their respective minds. So that led us to videotape the interactions, making two copies instead of one. And then as soon as the interactions were over, we set
up. Let me just interrupt. You were videotaping them secretly, too. People didn't even know.
No, we had to go in and inform them in a debriefing that we'd done that, and get them to give their consent for us to use the tapes as data. The reason for not telling them beforehand is that we wanted the interactions to be natural and spontaneous, and if you know beforehand that your initial interaction with the stranger is going to be taped, then it's probably going to alter your behavior. So at the end of the...
And that is so important, what you just said right there. That is so, so important. Anyway, sorry, go on.
So, you know, at the end of the interaction, we had to, at that point, tell them that there was more going on than they realized, and that, in fact, while they'd been left alone, presumably to wait together for the experimenter to get back, we'd actually been recording the initial interaction. And we wanted now to find out what they were thinking and feeling throughout that interaction. At this point, we often recruited them as members of the research team, so to speak. We told them, you people are the world's greatest experts on the thoughts and feelings you had during that interaction. In fact, you are the only experts. And so what we'd like to do is put you in separate cubicles, show you the videotape of the interaction you were just in, and ask you to pause the tape at each of the points where you remember having had a specific thought or feeling. So they're put in separate rooms. They can stop the tape at will at all the points where they distinctly had a thought or feeling, and they write down the content of each thought or feeling in special forms that we provide them. Now, for a while, we were doing studies focused on the content of their thoughts and feelings, how the kinds of thoughts and feelings they reported were related to their personality characteristics, to their perceptions of each other as interaction partners, and so on. But it wasn't too long before I realized, look, if we can measure their actual thoughts and feelings, why don't we, after both partners have listed their respective thoughts and feelings, why don't we take them through the tape of the interaction again, and this time pause the tape at each of the points where their partner reported the thought or feeling and tell them, now it's your job to make your best guess about what your partner was thinking and feeling at each of these points. In effect, we were asking them to read their interaction partner's minds at each of the points where the partner had thought.
Or effectively, what you were evaluating was the quality of the empathy in each side.
Yeah, you can. The term we use, which is an inversion of an earlier term used by the clinical psychologist Carl Rogers, is empathic accuracy. Back in the 1950s, Rogers talked about accurate empathy. We flipped those terms around to emphasize the accuracy part of it. Because what
I think that's it. Because empathy is a bad term. It's so complicated.
Oh, empathy is an umbrella term in which people have tried, under which people have tried to fit just about everything.
Are you aware of Simon Baron Cohen is now, the terms that he uses is cognitive empathy and affective empathy. And so effectively what you are measuring is cognitive empathy.
Well, yes and no, because we assess accuracy in inferring the specific content of other people's feelings as well as their thoughts. So although there is a long tradition in the research on empathy of breaking it down along the lines of cognitive versus affective, the division is really one of inferring the content of thoughts versus feelings. And from a practical standpoint, we haven't found that the distinction makes much difference in our research. I can imagine contexts where it might, but for our purposes, empathy for thoughts and empathy for feelings result in scores that are highly correlated. So that's essentially the procedure. With the addition that after we have all their thoughts and feelings plus their inferences about the content of their partner's thoughts and feelings, we can have the trained raters in our lab compare each of the actual thoughts and feelings with the inferred thought or feeling that the interaction partner wrote down, and they can assign accuracy points based on how closely the inferred thought or feeling matches the content of the actual thought or feeling. And when you add up all those points and divide by the number of inferences made, you get essentially a percentage correct measure of empathic accuracy or of successful mind reading. So the measure we use varies on a scale from 0 to 100, where 0 is totally clueless, had no idea what the other person was thinking or feeling, to a theoretical limit of 100, which would be perfect empathic accuracy, which we never see in our research.
Yeah, I'm guessing 30 to 60%?
That's right. If people get a general sense of the theme of the interaction and they apply other knowledge, like a general stereotype that might apply to their partner, they can be somewhat accurate for those reasons, but not very. Accuracy at a baseline only averages about 5%. You put two strangers together, and you study several interactions between two strangers, their average empathic accuracy for that initial interaction is about 20% of the possible accuracy points. If you put two close friends together, goes up to 30%, which is a substantial improvement, but still very, very far from that theoretical ideal of 100% accuracy. Married couples are comparable to best friends, maybe a little bit higher. But there seems to be over the course of 20 years, a kind of implicit upper limit on accuracy scores, and it seems to be around 60%. We just don't see people scoring in the 80s, 90s, or even the high 70s.
Why do you think that is?
I've been giving it a lot of thought. There's a couple of reasons. One is because this kind of empathic accuracy depends on complex psychological inference based on imperfect cues. People are not always telling you everything that's going on in their minds when you're talking to them. And so it's reasonable to expect less than 100% accuracy for that reason. But I think that maybe a more interesting and profound reason is that evolution doesn't want us to be perfect mind readers.
Right, and you talk about that in your book where you say, and I actually got kind of sad when I read that, we don't want 100% accuracy because there needs to be things hidden to make relationships last.
Well, and I think the primary reason why evolution might have calibrated it much lower than 100% is that the prime directive in nature, according to Darwin's theory of evolution, is making sure that your genes go on to the next generation. And what that means, basically, is that you put your genes in the genes of your closest kin, your children, your grandchildren in particular, you put them first. If you were 100% accurate in inferring everyone's thoughts and feelings, and you were perfectly aware of their needs, you might try to divert your resources to them instead of to your children, and put your own genes at risk. Either your own direct genes by giving away things that preserve your life to others, or your children's genes, which after all are yours. And so I think that there's a sense in which perfect empathic accuracy would violate this prime directive of Darwinian theory.
Damn, that's profound. Is this something you that wasn't in the book. Is this something you figured out after the book?
Something I've been thinking about. I didn't really feel comfortable putting it in the book, but I just offered it as a hypothesis in a commentary that's coming out this year. I don't know quite how one would go about testing this evolutionary idea that nature has calibrated human empathy at this general level, but I think it's a very plausible hypothesis. I encourage people to think about it and try to figure out ways to test it.
I admit to being a little bit selfish having you doing this interview, because I was wondering if you might have had, since the book was published in 2003, whether you might have had some observations like that, and I guess I was not disappointed. That's amazing. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, we obviously need empathy as a skill. People have to be good enough at reading other people's thoughts and feelings that other people can't lie to them repeatedly and take advantage of them. We have to be able to see bad things coming in our relationship with others. Perfect empathy could be, I think, more of a curse than a blessing.
Because you'd be suffering all the time because you'd be feeling so much for other people.
And there's another aspect to it which is kind of hinted at by an old Star Trek episode. You remember that in the second Star Trek series, there is a character called Deanna Troi, who was half human, half Betazoid. What she could do was not read other people's minds in the sense that she could infer in very detailed ways the specific thoughts and feelings they were having. What she could do is pick up on the general emotional tone of other people. But in one of the episodes, there was a Betazoid, a pure-blooded Betazoid, who had this phenomenal ability to be virtually 100% accurate in picking up other people's thoughts and feelings. The way he was portrayed in the episode was he was flooded with this. It was like a radio set to all channels simultaneously. Everybody's thoughts and feelings flooded in, and there was no room in his consciousness for anything else. The way he dealt with it in this fictional account in the episode was to get in a spaceship and go to the outer reaches of the galaxy so there'd be less of this background noise in his head. I don't think that we have to worry about anything resembling that, but I think that an oversensitivity to everyone around us, their needs, their thoughts, their feelings, might leave us less space just to be ourselves.
Do you think that that affects women in business?
In terms of traditional women's concerns and how women have been found to differ from men in their priorities in the workplace, probably does. The research that David McClellan did back in the 1950s on need for achievement didn't really involve women. For one thing, he was studying undergraduates at Harvard, where he was teaching in those early days, and they were mostly men. For another, the early results that he got seemed to be clearer for the men than for women, perhaps because it was the men who were going into the workplace. It was the men who were starting businesses as entrepreneurs. 20, 25 years later, people began to study women in the workplace. The whole landscape had changed. There were a lot more women in business. And the research showed that women were concerned about achieving as well, but they tended to define achievement differently from men. For men, it was climbing the corporate ladder. That meant competing with other men. There were winners and losers, and they accepted that. When women got into the workplace and displayed equal levels of ambition, some women adopted the male model, but others clung to a traditional female view, which said, look, I don't feel like I've won unless other people have won as well. And so a lot of women became concerned with win-win scenarios in which everybody's career advances, everybody does better, and they felt like it was inappropriate for them to get ahead at somebody else's expense. So there is a sense in which women who believe strongly in this alternative model, that we have to engineer things so that everybody succeeds, there are only winners and no losers, might make it more difficult for them to fire people, to make hard decisions about what's best for the business, even if it means sacrificing individual careers. So I think there's some signs of that out there. I was talking about this in my class yesterday, and one of the students who'd worked in the business world for a number of years told me that she worked in an organization where there were four women at the top, each of them with a salary in excess of $1 million a year, and she said the way they'd made it to the top was to beat the men at their own game. These women were totally masculine in their outlook, completely ruthless when it came to other people winning or losing. They just didn't care. The only thing that mattered to them was that they won. You can't fault the women's model as a kinder, gentler, more altruistic model, though.
I mean, I would agree, and I've noticed that in the tech world, some of the women who go far sometimes have. I feel sometimes even less empathy than some of the guys do. But maybe this is a conversation we should take a detour on. But I find it fascinating. The reason I was reading your book is because I've been diagnosed as being on the autism spectrum. I have a pretty mild case, but I have Asperger's syndrome, and so that puts us on a lower end of empathy. Did you do much research with people on the autism spectrum?
I have colleagues who have. I spent some time in Belgium on leave in 2005. I was at Ghent University, and there's a very active group led by Herbert Royers there, and he used our empathic accuracy methods, he and his colleagues, to study the ability of people, high-functioning Asperger's patients, to infer other people's thoughts and feelings using our procedure. In one of their studies, they carefully matched their Asperger's individuals with normally developing controls who had the same level of general intelligence. So there were pairs of individuals, one with an Asperger's diagnosis and the other without, whose IQ scores were approximately the same and who were also the same approximate age and gender. And the research showed that the Asperger's individuals did have more difficulty inferring thoughts and feelings when they viewed videotapes of interactions between strangers who they'd never met compared to the normally developing controls. What's striking about this is that you can't say the difference is based on IQ because of the careful matching on IQ. Other research showed that this difference in performance is reduced in a situation where the interactions are highly structured. So if the interactions become more structured and predictable, people with Asperger's have less difficulty making fairly accurate guesses about what the people on the videotape are thinking and feeling. Where they have the most difficulty is where things are completely unstructured.
And what do you mean by structured or unstructured?
Well, there's different ways to structure the interaction. I mean, one way would be to turn it into an interview with prepared questions. Another way to structure an interaction is to organize it in terms of a game with rules. So in one of the studies, Royers and his colleagues had people play a board game, and they videotaped that, which added structure. An unstructured conversation is when people just freely talk about whatever comes to mind, change the topics of conversation, without necessarily much warning.
And so you said you found like average empathic accuracy is around 20%. Do you have a percentage number of what you found or what they found in terms of Asperger's?
They do in their research, and the percentage won't vary greatly. So people without Asperger's, if you're recording interactions between strangers and you have participants who are inferring each other's thoughts and feelings during the interaction, you're going to see about an average of 20% accuracy points. People with Asperger's, as I recall, didn't fall too much short of that, but it was enough short of that so that the difference was statistically significant. And I'm sure that the difference was enough so that people who've been diagnosed with Asperger's, they noticed the difference in their own lives over and over again in the different interactions they're involved with.
I mean, are we talking like 15% versus 20% or like 5%?
Yeah, probably 15, 20%. So they're doing still considerably better than chance, that chance baseline being about 5%. They're doing quite well, perhaps, in comparison, say, to small children who aren't very good at mind reading, but they're not doing as good as the average person. And over the course of their day and over the course of months and years of interaction, they probably notice that they seem to be missing subtle things that other people seem to be responding to. And of course, if you look at people who have more severe cases of Asperger's or are in the range where a diagnosis of autism is made, then the deficit is more profound. And according to autism researchers like Simon Baron Cohen and others, when autism becomes extreme, he suggests that the victims of extreme autism are effectively mind blind, to use his term. They're pretty much incapable of inferring the specific content of other people's thoughts and feelings. In fact, some cases, clinicians have argued that their patients act as if they seem to be unaware even that other people have thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, I've been talking with a bunch of people that are nonverbal, basically, on the autism spectrum, and it's kind of cool because I can talk to them by the internet, and they can't really talk to other people very well, but they can chat with me, and One of the things that seems to be fairly common at that end of the spectrum is that they don't conceptualize that other people do have independent thought and feelings. Like, that one of the words one of them used was that they view other people as more or less furniture.
Well, then how is it that they can chat with them on the internet? You can't do that with furniture.
I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, it's a complicated world.
It's hard to consider the logical conundrum that presents.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think the way that, because they do, some of them move past that, and I think the way that they potentially move past that is there's enough beating on it cognitively that in the end, like, their mind makes a shift and they realize that actually people do have thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how it happens. I don't know. It gets a little bit confusing, but that's my guess.
That's not a kind of primary perception. It's nothing that is built into their very way of relating to the world. They have to start with that as a kind of premise and then operate from that premise.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand.
Well, when we interact with people, even as small children, there's a give and take. And by the time kids are about 3 years old, they begin to accept that their perspective is unique and that other people, even other species, like the family dog, may have a mind of its own, thoughts and feelings of its own. So you buy the, mom buys the little dog a rubber dog bone made out of some sort of blue material. The dog left it on the floor and the little kid thinks this is a great new toy, runs over to grab it, but the dog gets there first and gets its teeth in the other end of the bone, and now the kid and the dog are fighting for the bone, and the dog usually wins because his teeth are sunk into it. When that pops out of the kid's hands, this may be the first time the kid realizes this creature I've just been competing with has a mind of its own. I wanted that, but he didn't want me to have it. The Swiss child psychologist Piaget said that really small children are profoundly egocentric. That doesn't mean egotistical. What it means is they're so locked into their perspective, they can't even conceive of other people, let alone animals, having their own thoughts and feelings. But there are a variety of experiences which normally developing kids undergo that impress upon them that this is true. Losing the battle with the dog would be one of them. Lying there in your bed or your crib and having this giant person, your mom or dad, lean over and pick you up, hoist you up to the level of their shoulder and then walk around with you, looking down at the world from that perspective, they help you realize, oh, these big people have a view of things that's different from mine. And when I'm crawling around on the floor and the dog's licking my face, the dog is very big. But from up here, seeing the world from the shoulder of this giant, the dog looks really tiny. So there are a variety of experiences that the kids have growing up that impress on them what initially is a very disturbing realization, and that is my perspective is not universal. Because I want something doesn't mean that everybody in the world knows that I want it and also want me to have it. For some reason, that process seems to fail in people who are autistic.
Yeah, so let me just jump in here. If I were to suggest that the mirror neurons weren't firing correctly in various forms of reading interactions, which means they never really gain those realizations that you've just described, and it ends up causing them stress, which then freezes them at a certain developmental level, what would you say to that?
I would say that that's probably part of what's happening. But even the people who devote their lives to studying mirror neurons now acknowledge that mirror neurons are only a part of the picture, because the whole process is so complex and involves so many neural systems in the brain that we're eventually going to see that mirror neurons may be an important single piece of the puzzle, but it's not the whole puzzle.
Why do you say that?
Well, for you to be able to recognize that other people have thoughts and feelings and to infer what those thoughts and feelings are, you have to depend on parts of the brain other than mirror neurons. If I make an accurate inference based on a comment my best friend makes to me that has a reference to something that happened back when we were in high school, I also have to retrieve from memory that shared event and our discussion surrounding that shared event. So memory obviously plays a role too. We also know that we apply our social stereotypes. And in answering the question, what would a person from this background or in this particular social category have to say about what just happened? And would it be different from what a different person from a different background who represents a different social category have to say about the same event or incident?
But if we have someone who's, you know, at 3 years old, their mirror neurons haven't been firing correctly, and so when the dog, you know, bites them or, you know, takes the, whatever they was trying to get, or their parents pick them up, and so instead of gaining some understanding of that interaction and feeling what the other person's feeling, that it gives them PTSD, and so their emotional development freezes at that age, that would then basically account for everything, would it not?
It's interesting as a theory, and who knows? It may be that that is so basic, so elemental, the failure simply to have the insight that you are locked inside your own perspective and that other people, even other creatures, have a different perspective than yours. If you fail to grasp that basic insight, I could see how the whole developmental trajectory could change pretty radically. But what does it mean to have a failure of the mirror neuron system? Does it mean that none of them are working, or only some of them are working? And if it's a partial failure,
I would suggest that's a measure of how far along developmentally the person got.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have all sorts of interesting unanswered questions. Was the number of mirror neurons limited at birth because of an anomaly? Is it something that is affected by the course of development so that at a certain critical period people are supposed to develop a lot more new mirror neurons, but if certain things fail to happen in that development, the number simply doesn't develop? These are really interesting questions we don't have the answers to yet.
But you wouldn't rule out what I've said.
I agree with you that the fundamental insight that other people have thoughts and feelings is crucially important. And if there are people who, for whatever reason, probably organic reasons, fail to achieve that insight, that's got to have an enormously profound effect on their subsequent development. And your language may actually be accurately descriptive, that things freeze up at that point. And if they continue to progress, it may be at a relatively glacial pace.
Right. Or it may not progress.
Or it may not. But you like to think that because the brain is able to compensate for so many other kinds of deficits, that at least to some limited extent it can compensate for this one as well.
What we do know is that a percentage of people on the autism spectrum do progress. I talked to an autism researcher from Columbia in an interview a couple of days ago, and he's been monitoring big data sets of, he's got 8 million kids there, the data out in California. It's an anonymized database. But they know which ones go in and need services from the California government for autism, and they've sort of been doing all this massive crunching of the data. And he said that 10 to 15% of kids actually leave the autism spectrum. They call them bloomers. And he said that in their definition, that means they no longer require services from the California state for the autism spectrum. So that could indicate, if the mirror neurons concept is accurate, that maybe these kids have figured out how to activate their mirror neurons and have moved on. I guess I understand all this is speculative. I just was interested to get your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a neuroscientist, so ultimately I'm not the right person to ask, but like you, I have interest in these kinds of questions, and and anxiously waiting to see what our neuroscientist colleagues find. I think that to solve this kind of puzzle, to a lesser extent, will involve folks like me. To a greater extent, will involve them. Will also involve people like the one you just referred to, who man the big databases and track people who are in a system receiving special needs care, and looking at what happens across a wide group of these people. This is a big problem, and it's going to require lots of professionals tackling it from a variety of angles.
Another thing I found fascinating from your book was your research into the empathy of abusive men.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really profoundly interesting in the effectively that the women's empathic accuracy was normal and their understanding of frames was correct, and the abusive men, their general understanding of frames was incorrect. And just for those listening, I guess NLP has a concept of frames, which I think is similar here, but this is sort of the professional sociological version, which is basically the same thing, which says the direction or the path that the interaction is going through. Would you agree with that?
You could also think about it, if it's easier to remember, as a systematic bias, a predisposed way of seeing the world, which abusive, marital aggressive men cling to. They really need to see things in these terms. And what it amounts to, in their case, is maritally abusive men see women as harboring critical or rejecting thoughts and feelings about them, or if it's a woman they're not with, about their male partners. So the view that we discovered was prevalent among maritally abusive men was that all women are constantly having very negative, critical, rejecting thoughts and feelings about men. The men are very wedded to this idea that women think this way. And not only does this bias interfere with the men's ability to accurately infer what a woman's thinking or feeling, as you might expect, but it seems to have a function beyond that, which is to justify in the minds of abusive men that it's okay to show contempt for the woman, to physically abuse her, because after all, she deserves it. She's spending all her time, even if she's...
I just got to ask, how on earth did you find these guys? What did you, like, put an ad in the newspaper and say, you know, men who beat their wives, you know, can you please call us? I mean, what do you say?
Well, we could have, if we had had the contacts and the time, we could have recruited them from clinics. But what we did instead was we put an ad in the newspaper and we asked for married men. And we got a wide sample of married men who range from kind, loving husbands all the way to men who were both physically and emotionally abusive. The problem with that technique is you get only the percentage of abusive men that are already out there. In other research, you know, it makes sense to go right to the source and get a sample of only abusive men. But we wanted to have non-abusive men in the sample to use as a kind of control condition, to be able to compare men who don't abuse their wives with men who do. And when both kinds of men view videotapes in which a woman's describing to a male therapist her problems in her marriage, the non-abusive men, at times when the woman gets really emotional and is actually quite distraught talking about her problems with her male partner, the non-abusive men report that they feel sympathy for her at those points. And to the degree that they report feeling sympathetic, their empathic accuracy is higher. The abusive men act very differently. At those same points where the woman's highly emotional and very distraught, the abusive men report that they're feeling contempt for her. And, of course, they're not nearly as accurate in inferring her thoughts and feelings. But this was all I think, in the service of abusive men maintaining control in the relationship.
Do you think that this could also be caused by mirror neurons?
That's an interesting speculation. I don't believe that that's the cause in this case, and the reason is that in one of the more recent studies in this series, the abusive men were given the chance, in addition to inferring their own female partner's thoughts and feelings, to infer the thoughts and feelings of somebody else's female partner, and they did just fine in understanding her.
Well, you found also that you could motivate people to have higher levels of empathic accuracy. You could pay people to do it, and I thought that was incredible. I just about fell off my chair when I read that.
There's probably a limit to how much they'll improve, but in general, the research shows that women are pretty easily motivated to try to do their best in inferring the specific content of other people's thoughts and feelings. We think this is very consistent with the social stereotype that women are supposed to be empathic, women are supposed to be good at reading others, the so-called women's intuition phenomenon. And if you remind women of this stereotype, they do seem to try to up their game. They try to put more attention and effort into it, and they do better. Men, to motivate them, it took a different motivator initially, and that was to simply pay them. So they were given some practice trials, told to be as empathically accurate as possible, and to the extent that they were, they got paid actual money to convince them, if you really do your best, we'll pay you more.
And you paid like $2 per accurate empathic read, right?
It was the study was done by researchers at the University of Oregon, Christy Klein and Sarah Hodges, and that was the approximate amount, but it was sufficient to motivate these guys so that they closed any motivation gap between themselves and the women. They wound up doing just as well. So you can sort of extrapolate this to all the marriages and cohabitation relationships out there where the woman's thinking that he's not very good at being sensitive to my thoughts and feelings, and she's wondering, is it just something he's unable to do? No, the answer seems to be he's perfectly capable of doing it. It just takes more to motivate him.
Right. One of the things that, let me ask one, because we're running low on time, and this could easily, on my part, it could easily be about a 3-hour-long interview. There's so much you raise, it's interesting, but we've only got a few more minutes. Have you tried testing psychopaths or sociopaths in terms of their empathy accuracy?
I've been at conferences where people have discussed this and agreed that it's a good idea to do. Interestingly, people disagree about what the prediction should be. Some people argue that psychopaths should have very good empathic accuracy because people who work with psychopaths say they're often exceptionally good at manipulating people. They seem to have real insight into what other people are thinking and feeling, so they can push all the right buttons to get people to do what they want. So that by that perspective, the problem with psychopaths is not a lack of empathic accuracy. It's simply a lack of any sympathy for other people's thoughts and feelings. If I'm a psychopath, I know very well what you're thinking or feeling, but your thoughts and feelings don't really concern me except insofar as I can use them to manipulate you. If I were to manipulate you successfully and cause a lot of harm or damage, it wouldn't bother me in the slightest that you'd be left with those feelings.
You don't think, again, this could come down to a... Oh, sorry, go on.
Well, I use your feelings without caring about them, is basically that the perspective there. Other people argue that maybe psychopaths do have a deficit in empathic accuracy, but, we'll need to see the data to know what the answer is.
I mean, could this, again, come down to, like, a gap in mirror neurons, but a different set? And so they can see people. They know they've emotionally developed far enough along to have passed through all the critical development stages. But when it comes to certain actions, for example, am I hurting you? They don't feel that doesn't register via their mirror neurons.
This is a special case where the distinction you mentioned earlier between cognitive empathy and emotional empathy may turn out to be quite important. It may be that if there are, as you say, different mirror neurons that are implicated in cognitive versus emotional empathy, perhaps psychopaths have only a deficiency in regard to the ones that mediate emotional empathy. That is, they can infer other people's mental states quite well, but they don't have any sort of emotional resonance or sympathy with the other person.
Right. Now, empathy seems to decrease over time. In relationships, you see old married couples that, you know, fight a lot. Like, what happens there?
What seems to happen is that they get off the same page with each other. In research on newlyweds, empathy among newlywed couples is correlated with their having what's called a shared cognitive focus, being on the same page, being attuned to the general theme of each other's thoughts and feelings. With the older married couples, their lives seem to diverge. They have different responsibilities. Perhaps the wife's more involved in childcare, or she's got her own career outside the home. The husband's investing more of his thoughts and energies on his job and taking care of the family financially. And so people talk at each other more in the later years of marriage rather than trying to achieve a true meeting of the minds. People have different stories going on in their heads as they get further along into marriage. And they tend to be more and more preoccupied with those unique and different stories.
Do you have any pointers for making longer stage relationships like that more successful?
I haven't really thought about offering pointers, but if people are having problems staying in sync, they need to probably build in more life activities, either special events or daily events that bring them into sync. One bit of advice I heard when I was a much younger man was that if you spend even as little as 20 minutes with your partner, perhaps before you go to sleep at night, just talking, reviewing the events of the day, each of you giving your take on what happened, that provides this opportunity for people to get in sync with each other. It may be that you don't have to be empathically accurate in regard to your partner all day long, but it may be that marriages flourish when you have at least a special time like this, a short period where you begin by getting very much in sync, staying on the same page, and carry through an extended discussion.
And out of curiosity, just anecdotally, have you noticed, I mean, being in the empathy arena, are the relationships more durable in that arena, or are they the same as everyone else?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Adrian.
Well, there's a lot of empathy researchers. Like, do those guys tend to stay married? Just observationally, do they tend to stay married longer than other couples, or do they tend not to?
I don't have the data really to speculate on that. So, no, I haven't made any casual observations that would answer that.
Fair enough.
Or even suggest a hypothesis there.
It's just interesting. I mean, there's some of the things that some of you guys figure out I find it very amazing. I'm highly impressed. Is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered?
Can't think of anything obvious that we've left out as a topic that might interest the people who access your webpage. Yes, there is one, and that is the potential application. I know a lot of the people who tap your web page for ideas are in the business world.
Right.
One agenda, which we've never followed up on yet, but remains to be addressed, is can you use the techniques that we've developed in the lab to identify people who are more empathically accurate than average and use it as a selection tool for occupations where that's an important skill? So if people are involved in high-level negotiations or diplomacy, the ability to read the thoughts and feelings of the people you're negotiating with is important. If your job is conflict resolution, being able to read the thoughts and feelings on both sides of the conflict would be important. In sales and marketing, being able to read the thoughts and feelings of your potential or actual clients would be important. We found that through our method, not only can we measure people's empathic accuracy, but it's also possible by providing special kind of feedback training to increase empathic accuracy. So this has, I think, a lot of application most immediately for selecting people who are better than average in their empathic skills for a variety of professions, from counseling to police interrogation to sales and marketing to diplomacy, where you want people who are really good at that.
And so is this something, like if someone is seeing this and they wanted to increase the empathic accuracy of their team, is this something they can reach out to you for, or is that, where do they go if they want that?
They could contact me. There's information in the book, Everyday Mind Reading, about our research on feedback and its effect on empathic accuracy. We found that in the single session in which feedback was provided, empathic accuracy for a particular target could be boosted on average about 10%. 10% may not seem like a lot, but it can be a real advantage if you learn to do that consistently.
Could that sort of stuff be applied to the autism spectrum and to abusive men as well?
I'd hope that it could. Nobody's tackled that yet. I don't have any research specifically addressing it, but that's a wonderful idea.
Great. Anything else you'd like to mention?
No, I appreciate the chance to talk with you. It was a nice informal chat, just like you promised.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.